Hello and welcome to this week's Revisiting Old Favourites podcast in the Inner Sanctum. Thanks as always for joining me. So we're continuing our path to Rome, our pilgrimage to Rome with Hilaire Belloc. We are in Tuscany. We are not going to get to Rome in time for the Feast of St. Peter and Paul, which is when Belloc in real life back in 1901, I've forgotten, that when he arrived in Rome, we've actually been on the path to Rome for a year. It started last year around this time, and we haven't managed to get there. We're almost there, but Belloc's going to get there before us, so to speak, in the sense that he will be there on June the 29th. I think we won't. We're going to be a little bit late because this is the last Revisiting Our Favourites podcast before June 29th. It'll be in July next time I record one. So that being so, I'm not the most technological of people, as you know. It doesn't take much to confuse me, and then I got confused, but we're good. So, without further ado, let's continue as Belloc trudges his way Romewards, heading south through Tuscany, and apart from the trudge and the progress towards the Eternal City, he obviously takes waxes lyrical and tangential on various things in the day. Amongst other things, he talks about St. Augustine and King Alfred the Great. So, without further ado, let's continue on the path to Rome with Hilaire Belloc. In this way, I have got over between 20 and 30 miles of road, which were tramped in the dark, and the description of which would have plagued you worse than a swarm of hornets. Oh, blessed interlude! No struggling moon, no mist, no long-winded passages upon the genial earth, no the sense of the night, no marvels of the dawn, no rodomontade, no religion, no rhetoric, no sleeping villages, no silent towns, there was one, no rustle of trees, just a short story, and there you have a whole march covered as though a brigade had swung down it. A new day has come, and the sun has risen over the detestable parched hillocks of this downward way. No, no, Lector, do not blame me that Tuscany should have passed beneath me unnoticed, as the monotonous sea passes beneath a boat in full sail. Blame all those days of marching, hundreds upon hundreds of miles, that exhausted the powers of the mind. Blame the fiery and angry sky of Etruria that compelled most of my way to be taken at night. Blame St. Augustine, who misled me in his confessions by talking like an African of the icy shores of Italy. Or blame Rome, that now more and more drew me to herself as she approached from 6 to 5, from 5 to 4, from 4 to 3. Now she was but 3 days off. The third sun after that I now saw rising would shine upon the city. I did indeed go forward a little in the heat, but it was useless. After an hour I abandoned it. It was not so much the sun, though that was intemperate and deadly. It was rather the inhuman aspect of the earth which made me despair. It was as though the soil had been left imperfect and rough after some cataclysm. It reminded me of those bad lands in the west of America, where the desert has no form, and where the crumbling and ashy look of things is more abhorrent than their mere desolation. As soon march through evil dreams. The north is the place for men. Edom is there, and the four rivers of paradise are the Seine, the Huatuas, the Thames, and the Avon. There are grasses there, and the trees are generous, and the air is an unnoticed pleasure. The waters brim up to the edges of the fields, but for this bare Tuscany I was never made. How far I had gone I could not tell, nor precisely how much farther San Quirico, the neighbouring town, might be. The imperfect map I had bought at Siena was too minute to give me clear indications. I was content to wait for evening and then to go on till I found it. An hour or so in the shade of a row of parched and dusty bushes, I lay and ate and drank my wine and smoked, and then all day I slept, and woke a while and slept again more deeply. And how people sleep and wake, if you do not yet know it after so much of this book, you never will. It was perhaps 5 o'clock, or rather more, when I rose unhappily and took up the ceaseless road. Even the goodness of the Italian nature seemed parched up in those dry hollows. At an inn where I ate, they shouted at me, thinking in that way to make me understand, and their voices were as harsh as the grating of metal against stone. A mile farther, I crossed a lonely line of railway. Then my map told me where I was, and I went wearily up an indefinite slope under the declining sun, and thought it outrageous that only when the light had gone was there any tolerable air in this country. Soon the walls of San Quirico, partly ruinous, stood above the fields, for the smallest places here have walls. As I entered its gate, the sun set, and as though the call coming suddenly had magic in it, everything turned kinder. A church that could wake interest stood at the entry of the town. It had stone lions on its steps, and the pillars were so carved as to resemble knotted ropes. There, for the first time, I saw in procession one of those confraternities which in Italy bury the dead. They had long and dreadful hoods over their heads, with slits for their eyes. I spoke to the people of San Quirico, and they to me. They were upstanding and very fine and noble in the lines of the face. On their walls is set a marble tablet, on which it is registered that the people of Tuscany, being asked whether they would have their hereditary duke or the House of Savoy, voted for the latter by such and such a great majority. And this kind of tablet, I afterwards found, was common to all these small towns. Then, passing down their long street, I came, at the farther gate, to a great sight, which the twilight still permitted me to receive in its entirety. For San Quirico is built on the edge of a kind of swell in the land, and here where I stood one looked over the next great wave, for the shape of the view was, on a vast scale, just what one sees from a lonely boat looking forward over a following sea. The trough of the wave was a shallow purple valley, its arid quality hidden by the kindly glimmer of evening. Few trees stood in it to break its sweep, and its irregularities and mouldings were just those of a sweep of water after a gale. The crest of the wave beyond was 17 miles away. It had, as have also such crests at sea, one highest toppling peak in its long line, and this, against the clear sky, one could see to be marked by buildings. These buildings were the ruined castle and walls of Radicofani, and it lay straight on my way to Rome. It is a strange thing, arresting northern eyes, to see towns thus built on summits up into the sky, and this height seemed the more fantastic because it was framed. A row of cypress trees stood on either side of the road where it fell from San Quirico, and exactly between these, this high crest, a long way off, was set as though by design. With more heart in me, and tempted by such an outline as one might be by the prospect of adventure, I set out to cross the great bare run of the valley. As I went, the mountain of Amiato came more and more nearly abreast of me in the west. In its foothills near me were ravines and unexpected rocks. Upon one of them hung a village. I watched its church and one tall cypress next it as they stood black against the last of daylight. Then for miles I went on the dusty way and crossed by old bridges, watercourses, in which stood nothing but green pools, and the night deepened. It was when I had crossed the greater part of the obscure plain at its lowest dip, and not far from the climbs up to Radicofani, that I saw lights shining in a large farmhouse, and though it was my business to walk by night, yet I needed companionship, so I went in. There, in a very large room, floored with brick and lit by one candle, were two fine old peasants, with faces like apostles, playing a game of cards. There also was a woman playing with a strong boy child that could not yet talk, and the child ran up to me. Nothing could persuade the master of the house but that I was a very poor man who needed sleep, and so good and generous was this old man that my protest seemed to him nothing but the excuses and shame of poverty. He asked me where I was going. I said, to Rome. He came out with a lantern to the stable and showed me there a manger full of hay, indicating that I might sleep in it. His candle flashed upon the great silent oxen standing in rows, their enormous horns, three times the length of what we know in England, filled me with wonder. Well, may it count to me as gain. Rather than seem to offend him, I lay down in that manger, though I had no more desire to sleep than has the flittermouse in our Sussex gloamings. Also, I was careful to offer no money, for that is brutality. When he had left me, I took the opportunity for a little rest, and lay on my back in the hay, wide awake and staring at darkness. The great oxen champed and champed their food with a regular sound. I remembered the steerage in a liner, the noise of the sea and the regular screw, for this it exactly resembled. I considered, in the darkness, the noble aspect of these beasts, as I had seen them in the lantern light, and I determined, when I got to Rome, to buy two such horns, and to bring them to England, and have them mounted for drinking horns, great drinking horns, a yard deep, and to get an engraver to engrave a motto for each. On the first, I would have, King Alfred was in wantage born, he drank out of a ram's horn, here is a better man than he who drinks deeper, as you see. Thus, my friends, drinking out of it, should lift up their hearts and no longer be oppressed with humility. But on the second, I determined for a rousing Latin thing, such as men shouted round campfires in the year 888 or thereabouts. So, the imagination fairly set going and taking woodcock's flight, snipe fashion, zigzag and devil may care for the rules, this seemed to suit me. Salve cornu cornuum, cornutorum vis bonum, munus excellens deum, gregis o presidium, sitis desiderium, dignum cornuum cornu, Rome memor salve tu, tibi cornuum cornu tu. Lector, that means nothing. Auctor, shut up! Tibi cornuum cornu tu, tibi clamo te saluto, salve cornu cornuum fortunatum da domum. And after this cogitation amusing, I got up quietly so as not to offend the peasant, and I crept out and so upwards onto the crest of the hill. Delightful. Again, thanks so much for joining me. We are getting there to Rome. We've been going for a whole year. I think this is maybe week 51 or week 52 of our reading of The Path to Rome by Hilaire Belloc. Thanks for staying, those of you that have, staying with me week by week, mile by mile, trudge by trudge on our path to Rome, on our pilgrimage, no less, to Rome with Hilaire Belloc. We will eventually get there. It's another couple of weeks or so, I think. Okay, so thanks, as always, for joining me. Please do join me next week. Thanks for being a member of the Inner Sanctum. Until next time, goodbye and God bless.